may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Andrew George, and I represent Nathaniel Dennis. I'd like to request 4 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
Right.
Thank you. This case involves a petition for a writ of actual innocence that was dismissed based on an insufficient record. Mr. Dennis was convicted in 1998 of a beating and shooting at the Newport News Daily Press based on an eyewitness identification that never really made much sense at the time. The original arresting detective in the case reinvestigated the case, determined that they had the wrong guy, that the real perpetrator
what
was
difference
a man
does
named
it, what, I mean,
excuse me.
What difference does the opinion of the detective make? I mean, in other words, if he, I mean, the you have new facts, like the inmates, Ms. Walker, corroboration of Ms. Walker by one of her friends. Those are facts.
That's
the opinion of a detective or of a whoever, what weight to the mix does that have?
None, Your Honor. I was just giving the background of how this came about.
But may I ask you this practical question? Because I understand your client is in Alabama, and one, I don't know what the court's going to do with this case, but one possible outcome is some kind of hearing on all these facts. And so then now, it's one thing when someone's sitting in, you know, Red Onion or whatever, and we just bring him in and we have a hearing. Someone's crossed state lines, pending trial. Logistically, where are we with that case? Because I don't think we would want to gum up the works one way or the other with what's going on elsewhere.
I think the odds of gumming up the works are very low. Mr. Dennis has been waiting 7.5 years for
trial
in Alabama.
In other words, I mean, I didn't know if maybe he's in the midst of trial as we speak, or the trial date is next month, or whatever.
No, the trial date is currently scheduled for March. That's an administratively set date. It's based on the experience with the case, that's not likely to stick.
Gotcha. Okay.
If this court were to remand it, the case for a hearing, then we would approach the Alabama courts and request.
You see the dilemma. I mean, these capital trials, sometimes they take a while, and then you don't want to have conflicting orders, bring them to Virginia, you know. And
absolutely.
So
I think in this, of all cases, the risk is exceedingly low, given that Mr. Dennis has been sitting in the Houston County, Alabama jail with nothing to do for 7.5 years.
Understood.
What about the affidavits of the individuals who now cannot testify?
The two who have died?
Yes. What do we
so, those affidavits obviously cannot be considered with as much weight as the ones who can be brought to a court and can testify. I think that the court is still entitled to consider them, depending on how an evidentiary hearing were to go. Those affidavits would still be potentially admissible on impeachment grounds if Mr. Musawir, the alleged perpetrator, was to testify, and the court would be allowed to consider them. However, we accept that they would be granted less weight than the other affidavits of individuals who are still living.
Okay.
And so the underlying issue here really is the dismissal of the petition based on an insufficient record. The main ground that was cited for the dismissal was the unsworn account of the alleged perpetrator himself, as filtered through a police interview. Mr. Musawir has never said a word under oath in this case, and yet his word was taken as true and used as a basis to dismiss Mr. Dennis's petition. He has never been cross-examined. He's never testified at all, but his word was taken as true. And there was no reason.
Well, it could be that, or just simply, you know, he has no incentive to lie. I mean, it's one thing when he's awaiting trial on what he faced, but now he's been convicted of that, so that's gone. And then this particular crime, there's no capital component to it because happily the victim survived. So he, you know, there's no reason why. You know, yeah, I did it. So why couldn't a court look at that and say, well, you know, I don't know if he's telling the truth or not, but the bottom line is, it's just not enough by this fairly high standard that the petitioner has to meet.
I think that that's a determination that would be properly made after a hearing when he's actually testified and his credibility can be tested under cross-examination. Mr. Musawir, I think, could arguably have an incentive to lie. He's being accused of a very serious crime here. And he has, up until, I believe, 2014, he was pursuing habeas remedies in the case for his shooting Ms. Walker, our chief witness. And so he certainly at that time still believed that he could ultimately prevail in that case, and so he would at that point have quite a bit of incentive not to be implicated in a separate attempted murder. Above that, though, Your Honor, there's no reason for crediting Mr. Musawir's word. No reason was given, and there is no reason without him having testified. Crediting his word over the word of the seven affiants, or the seven witnesses who gave statements in Mr. Dennis's case.
Is the standard that we apply to the CAV's decision not to remand this for an evidentiary hearing abuse of discretion?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that's right that it is an abuse of discretion standard. The Court of Appeals certainly has quite a bit of discretion, and the statute provides for that. There's quite a bit of discretion in how it handles a petition for a writ of actual innocence on non-biological grounds.
So while we might have said it should go back, where is the abuse of discretion in the CAV saying we don't need an evidentiary hearing?
Let me clarify for one moment. So I think that this court's review of the record is de novo. I think that the Court of Appeals had... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think that the Court of Appeals has quite a bit of discretion in how it deals with a petition for writ of actual innocence. However, I think that discretion should properly end when the Commonwealth is relying on new witness statements.
My view of the case may be incorrect, but the decision as at this Court of Appeals level, the decision as to whether to send it back for an evidentiary hearing is made at that court as if it were sitting as the trial court. And so wouldn't that be an abuse of discretion standard if they decide this does not need an evidentiary hearing? And I'm asking the question because I don't know.
That's right, Your Honor. It is an abuse of discretion standard as to whether or not to order an evidentiary hearing. I think that is correct because the statute does provide the Court of Appeals with a lot of discretion as to whether or not it believes additional fact-finding is necessary. As to factual determinations that are then made, if those factual determinations are made and used by the Court of Appeals in making an ultimate decision, that too would be entitled to discretion. But here, there was no fact-finding that ever happened. There wasn't any.
Well, so I think it's in your point, though, that when allegations of this type are raised, that it is that they require an evidentiary hearing, and therefore, which may not happen in every case, may be just a silly, bunch of nonsense, in which case no hearing is required. But your point, I take it, is that the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in not at least ordering a hearing given all the new allegations on both sides.
That's correct, and specifically because the new allegations on both sides were being raised through witness accounts, witness testimony, and there's no way to resolve which witnesses are telling the truth and which ones aren't without at least putting them on the stand to testify.
So there's the question of abuse of discretion, whether to have a hearing or not. Then there's also the legal standard the Court of Appeals employed, which, as I understand it, is you didn't prove that these claims were true, and therefore, you fail at the threshold. But we would review that legal standard de novo, correct?
That's correct. That's the distinction, Your Honor.
Okay. And can you explicate that in your brief, why you think that was wrong?
Why we think the court was...
Why you think the Court of Appeals' legal standard that it employed in this case was flawed?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think following this court's Watford decision that the question of whether or not the affidavits that were provided in this case needed to be quote-unquote true may be an open legal question at this point, but the bottom line is, from our position, they were true. We met the standard that applied under Carpenter. We also
It just seemed like a... I mean, first of all, I understand drawing from the Carpenter line of cases where you have a recantation problem, and the witness said one thing under oath, now they're saying something else under oath, and maybe there's a third thing at the hearing, and the bottom line is the petitioner has to prove that the new version is actually true, or they just don't meet their burden of proof. So that's a discrete problem with recantation. But this is a recantation case, It's, you know, he confessed to inmates, and then he's making other statements. So to me, the question is, does that standard even apply here? Because if it does apply, it really creates catch-22 for our petitioners, because they have to prove it's true, but then they can't have a hearing to prove it's true.
Couldn't agree more, Your Honor. The Carpenter standard did seem like it was specifically applying in the recantation context. It makes the most sense to apply it in that context because it is very hard at the outset to prove 100% that a witness statement is true. Here we, I think, do prove that because we have corroboration between witness statements, but the reality is that the best way to test this is through a hearing.
What, you know, you're focusing on the granular. The proof is clear and convincing evidence that if this evidence were heard with all the other evidence, that a reasonable jury would have acquitted. That's completely different from simply proving this fact or that fact is true, or whether this inmate's lying or this inmate's being paid off or whatever, which happens all the time. You can't. I don't see the capital that you place on such things when the ultimate question is, if a reasonable jury had heard this, clear and convincing evidence says we all know as judges they would have acquitted. Now, the way I read the Court of Appeals is they looked at all this and they saw these affidavits and they said, all right, let's suppose every one of them is factually true. There's a date messed up on one, but there's this whole drama is who's paying who what, and it's a bunch of inmates with all the drama that's going on there. And I think what they're saying is, look, I can say on the face of it without hearing anything more that if I threw this into a trial with all the evidence, with the victim identifying the defendant with the same certitude that was identified, that I do not believe clear and convincing evidence shows that a reasonable jury would have acquitted as opposed to would have not convicted. So,
yes, Your Honor, and what we're saying is that based on the record that existed at the time, it wasn't sufficient to make that determination because the evidence that was being cited against these witness statements was the word of the alleged perpetrator who's never testified under oath, several of the former inmates who provided statements in this case were not inmates at the time, and Kenetta Walker is not an inmate, she's not a felon, she's just a person who the alleged perpetrator happened to shoot in the head and survived. Nor is Ellen Speller a felon. She is a witness who corroborates Ms. Walker. And these are witnesses who should have been permitted to testify. I see my time is running out for rebuttal.
We've got 2 minutes and 25 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. My name is Alfonso Simon. I'm with the Office of the Attorney General, and on behalf of the Commonwealth, I respectfully request that this Court affirm the Court of Appeals' order denying Mr. Dennis's petition for a writ of actual innocence in this case. Mr. Dennis has presented 6 assignments of error in this case, and we submit that each of those errors or leave each of those assignments of error without merit. First, he asserts that the Court of Appeals failed to properly consider the affidavits of Donald Poindexter and Harry Cutchin. We submit that the Court of Appeals order itself reflects that the Court of Appeals did consider those affidavits. You have in the order the fact that the Court of Appeals briefly summarizes both of those affidavits and specifically finds that Mr. Dennis did not show that the allegations that were alleged in the affidavits were true.
Well, here's what we have. We have a number of inmates, 2 of whom have passed away. One is happily testifies for $400. You have someone who was shot in the head who appears would sign whatever's put in front of her. But nevertheless, the claim is another individual repeatedly confessed to committing a crime. He physically closely resembles Mr. Dennis. And so, you know, you have this conflict and this new evidence. Mr. Musawir denies it, albeit not under oath. Why not have a hearing to sort all this out? If it's a house of cards, presumably it will collapse the hearing. Commonwealth is vindicated. But you see the dilemma of saying, well, you didn't prove your allegations are true, but we're not going to give you a hearing to have that opportunity to prove the allegations are true. Why not have that hearing?
It's within the Court of Appeals' discretion whether or not to have that hearing, and they have broad discretion. They're sitting and reviewing petition of writ of actual innocence in their original jurisdiction. They can review the affidavits, the statements, the interviews, the full record that's provided to them, and everything that's provided in the petition, and the response, and any reply that's filed. And they have the ability to weigh that as a fact finder. And they can determine after looking at the documents and make an assessment, do we believe that we need to have...
And if they had said what Justice Kelsey alluded to earlier, which is, look, you have some inmates who are going to be impeached with the criminal records and so on. And so even accepting all of that, we're just not convinced that when weighed against, you know, all that was presented at trial and so on, that by clear and convincing evidence, petitioner, you proved your case. That'd be one thing. But then to say you didn't prove what your allegations that they were true, I just had trouble with the way it unfolded there, and maybe I'm missing something, so maybe you can help me with that. But it just seemed like the standard that was employed is somewhat paradoxical.
I think in looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, what they're doing when they're saying that you didn't, when they were saying that Mr. Dennis didn't establish that the facts were contained in the affidavits, that those allegations were true, what they were doing was making the factual determination that would lead to them deciding whether or not the information was material, which is required under subsection 7. And that's their assessment. We, the court's finding, as a matter of fact, these statements, we don't believe you've shown that these statements are true. That's just the court making that determination. And those findings are supportable by the record, because if you look at the statements themselves and you look at the trial record and other information that was provided in the record, you see all these inconsistencies that would cut against whether or not, like, if you were to...
Is it problematic, counsel, that the Court of Appeals appears to have applied a Carpenter standard, which by its facts would apply to recantation testimony? In Haas, we seem to draw a distinction between recantation testimony and new witness testimony, and this would be, in my estimation, new witness testimony. So is it problematic that the CAB appears to have applied a Carpenter recantation standard?
I'll just admit, I don't believe that the court did apply the recantation standard.
Well, let's presume that they did. If they did, is it problematic?
I would say it would not be problematic, because that standard is still basically looking all the statements that are provided. Is the for the evidence to be material, it has to be true. And in looking at the recantation case, like looking at Carpenter and his assessment of recantation, there is that that assessment that recantations are automatic, like they're considered to be suspect, because you have this conflict of, was the person telling the truth now, or were they telling the truth before? But the underlying idea that the evidence that's presented must be true for it to be material, that's not problematic.
So we don't, from your perspective, we don't say, well, recantation evidence has got to be really, really true, but just a bunch of inmates filing affidavits with a AI petition can be mostly true, or sort of true, or sketchy, but could be true.
Right. What you have to show is that the evidence is true. It's not some difference. Like in essence, what I'm trying to say is, in looking at the reason recantation is set aside as different is because you do have this immediate conflict of dealing with when is the person telling the truth.
How do you show it's true other than having a hearing, where you bring in the witnesses who testify to that, and you bring in the witnesses who say it's not true, and then you decide who's telling the truth? How can you do that without some type of background information?
Reviewing the evidence, in this case, in looking at the affidavits, assuming that the person that would testify would state, with their testimony would be consistent with those affidavits, and then comparing that with the information that you have on the record to see if there's, look at the consistencies, or if there are inconsistencies that...
Okay, well, let's think about this particular instance where these inmates say that Mr. Al Wasari said these things. Well, not he actually did it, that's a different thing, but he claimed when he was in prison that he, you know, actually perpetrated this crime. And what do they have to counterbalance that? he said he didn't, right?
Yes.
Why do they believe him? I mean, why does that make it not true? Because he says he didn't do it. Good enough for us. Inmate says he didn't do it. Is that?
I would say that the finding of the Court of Appeals isn't going to the extent of finding that what Amos Ware says is true. It never makes a specific finding that what he says is true. What it really is doing is pointing out that you have these inconsistencies between statements given by these five inmates and former inmates versus this Amos Ware who's consistently said, when talked with law enforcement, when he talked with the Innocence Project people, that he was not involved in the crime.
But and he's never said anything under oath, though, right? So can we even look at that? I mean, it's one thing to have an affidavit where someone says, look, I could be prosecuted for perjury or whatever. But you can say anything you want all day long. I mean, but it's not under oath, doesn't have that solemnity. I'm trying to figure out if we can even consider that.
I would say under the rule that, under the statute, the Commonwealth can proffer evidence that goes to the guilt or innocence of the person.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be evidence that would have been admissible at trial. And the Court of Appeals is supposed to take it for what it is, make its own assessment, and decide what weight to give to that evidence.
Right.
And looking at what the Court of Appeals did here, the way I read it, it appears what the Court of Appeals did was it has these affidavits, and it says, well, we have these allegations that Amos Ware is admitting that he committed this assault. Weighed against the fact that in other instances he has said, I have not committed this assault.
Right.
And the court's understanding, like looking at this and reviewing this and finding, you know, in light of the fact we do have this conflict, that's not going to be enough to show that you're entitled to a writ of action.
Right, and I will say I have a concern. That, I mean, you don't want to green light, run off to a hearing or grant the writ every time an inmate says, oh, well, he, you know, said this or whatever. But you got Kenita Walker, which is corroborated by her friend. Now, I understand there's some problems and weaknesses there, too. But you have a little more than just, you know, some inmates. And then some of the inmates are former inmates. I don't know if that matters, but they seem to think it does. So it isn't an instance of just, well, there's inmates and inmates lie, and so ergo, we discount it. You have a little bit more.
But in this case, you also have the court also has the opportunity to review the specific allegations that are raised in the affidavits, and you have inconsistencies.
Oh, yeah, and there's plenty. And not to mention the fact that, I mean, she says at the sentencing in the Amos Ware case that she has all kinds of memory problems. So then, I mean, so right out of the gate, there's a problem right there. And the fact that at her, as I recall, at the Amos Ware, the underlying trial, she said nothing about this being a getaway driver and all of that. It was all about him being angry at her and possessive and whatever.
That's correct. And on top of that, you also have the inconsistencies that are contained in the statement itself. Not only do you have the fact that it lists the wrong date for the incident, you have her saying that she showed up hour before.
There weren't two incidents. Are you really going to rely upon the date being off by a few days? I mean, is that really something that
you're going to
turn on?
I mean, that it goes to looking at assessing.
There was only one incident of this magnitude, of this nature. And I'm just trying to parse out which facts are really matter in this particular instance.
Well, that would go, I would say that particular fact goes to her overall credibility in signing the affidavit. If you want to look at the specific facts that are more, that point to, that create more issues, first you have her saying that she arrived at the scene 45 minutes to an hour earlier than the attack occurred, because she said that she got there around midnight and the attack didn't occur to between 12:30 and 1. You have her claiming that he came out with a bag of coins, or an initial statement, a bag of coins, later a bag of money, and there's been no evidence in the record that indicated, that substantiated that a bag of coins or a bag of money was missing. That
Aren't these the sort of issues, though, that ought to be resolved based upon testimony in front of a fact finder?
It's within the court. It's within the Court of Appeals' discretion whether or not they believe that that was warranted. And we believe that the Court of Appeals did not abuse its discretion in making that assessment that a hearing was warranted.
Could they? Could the Court of Appeals have taken all the affidavits? Everything has been presented in this case, just as it is at face value, and put it on the table with all the information that came out of trial, including the victim's insistence that this was the man after having a considerable amount of time to see him while the torture and the violence occurred. And couldn't they have said, you know what, I don't think by clear and convincing evidence that a reasonable jury would have acquitted. Might have acquitted, could have acquitted, maybe probably 51% would have acquitted, but clear and convincing evidence? I don't see this back and forth between these inmates and this one other bad guy. It's something that convinced me a jury at clear and convincing evidence would not have convicted. So it seems to me the forest is much bigger than these individual trees were invading.
I would agree, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals could do that. And the Court of Appeals did do that. Made this assessment that you look at all of this evidence and one thing we're forgetting is when you're looking at whether or not somebody's entitled to the petition, you're weighing it also against the evidence that was presented at trial. You have Mr. Harrison, who made this identification. You also have information in the record that was provided where Mr. Harrison was visited by Detective Williams later and shown a different ID. He stuck with that identification he made at trial. And on top of that, in the second photo lineup, picture of Mr. Musawir was in there, and he identified that he knew who Mr. Musawir was, so that you have this less of a question of if he made an improper identification or misidentified Mr. Dennis as or mixed the two up. He knew who Al Musawir was.
And so you had those three or four witnesses who said that Mr. Dennis seemed to have a particular fixation with Mr. Harrison and some kind of beef with him that would explain why it wasn't just a quick snatch-and-grab robbery, that there was this protracted abuse that unfolded.
Yes, you have.
But isn't the problem you have is that the Court of Appeals didn't assume that these affidavits were true and do the analysis. They said that the defendant didn't reach the threshold of them even being able to consider the other evidence to determine whether or not he reached the standard. And they didn't even have a hearing before they did that, based upon credibility. I mean, isn't that the crux of where that seems to be a problem?
And I think where you may see a problem, I'm seeing the court acting within its discretion after reviewing the individual facts, comparing it to the record that it had before it, finding that the discrepancies that were in with the statements that were made by the different inmates and former inmates did not match up or did not corroborate information that they knew was in the record, testimony that was in the trial, the allegations that it was a robbery when there's really, I mean, Mr. Dennis was never charged with a robbery and there was no concrete evidence that any money was stolen, and just the varying facts just don't match up with, in the Court of Appeals, within its discretion, determined after reviewing those documents, we don't believe a hearing was warranted. And I see that my time has expired, but I just request for the reasons that were stated and the reasons stated in the brief of this court.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 25 seconds.
Counsel, based upon your arguments, the Commonwealth's arguments, and all of the questions, the relief you sought was for the petition to be granted or alternatively for there to be a hearing in front of the circuit judge. We seem to be almost entirely on that alternative relief at this point. Do you agree?
I do agree.
That's where it's going to turn on whether you get the alternative relief or not.
And I think that's the appropriate outcome here, okay, given that we have conflicting witness testimony. Conflicting witness testimony is properly resolved by putting the witnesses on the stand and letting them testify and be cross-examined, letting Mr. Dennis's counsel have a chance to ask questions of Mr. Musawir under oath and see how he does. And if he turns out to be credible, then that's one thing. If he turns out not to be credible, that's another.
I mean, one basic point that I struggle with is the assertion that they resemble each other, and we have these grainy photos And so, for all I know, it's a bunch of hooey, or for all I know, it's a compelling argument. But on the record that we have, it's just hard to say one way or the other, that's right, or no, I just don't see it.
There's certainly not a basis on the record that we have to say that they don't.
I mean, we have photos of them, but they're not
That's
great.
Right, Your Honor. I'm sorry. That's right, Your Honor. We have photos. We also have witness statements. We have several of the affiants and Detective Williams himself who have said that, no, they do resemble each other. And they both resemble the description that was given by Mr. Harrison on the night when this happened to him, when he said he didn't know who had done this to him.
Well, where is this all going to go when the victim says, I know him, he's not the guy. And the guy that you convicted, that I testified against, he is the guy. What court's going to say, I'm going to believe a bunch of inmates getting together and coming up with something over the victim who says, I know it's not him because I've seen him before?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, it's not just a bunch of inmates. It is Kenneta Walker, the alleged getaway driver, too. And the court, that is a determination that the court could properly make depending on the strength of that evidence at the end of the hearing. That, you know, as much as Mr. Harrison's identification is powerful, Mr. Harrison didn't identify Mr. Dennis. He said he didn't know who had done this to him after the attack, and it was only later that he decided that it was...
I know, but he de-identified the now alleged attacker. That's really powerful if I'm a fact finder. I know this guy. I know his face. I've seen him before. The guy that beat me half to death is not this guy.
That's true.
And some court's going to say, well, I'm sorry, but we're just going to overrule that and say that any fact finder would have certainly at the level of clear and convincing evidence have said, no, actually, you're wrong. He is the guy. And this other guy you picked out is not him.
So, may I have leave to answer your question?
Yes.
So the reality is that this is not the first case of a potential wrongful conviction where there was an eyewitness identification by the victim, and sometimes the victims are wrong. They're sincere, but they're wrong. And it is quite possible that this is one of those cases where the court could make that determination. There's a lot of factors, and when we lay them out in our initial brief, there's a lot of factors to question this initial identification. And ultimately, that would be a question that would be properly considered after a hearing when the court has had an opportunity to look at all the evidence and say, you know what, the victim has made this identification, but that identification would not be a basis to convict. No reasonable juror would convict Mr. Dennis based on that identification in light of everything else that's come in today. Or maybe the judge wouldn't come out that way. We don't know because the hearing never happened. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Court is adjourned.
All rise.